Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riespendel, and I'm your host. On today's program, will low-power radio come to the AM dial? We'll be talking to Don Shellhart. He's one person out of a five-organization coalition that has petitioned the FCC to bring low-power radio to the AM dial, and the AM and the FCC has decided to actually look into it. He'll tell us more about that. And, of course, we're going to look at all the news of our media environment that we can fit in our headline news. Do stay tuned. Each week here on Media Geek, I try to bring you some news of our media environment that typically gets relegated to the back business pages of our print press and often doesn't get covered at all in the electronic press. We're talking about news of mergers, news of regulation, news of legislation, and I think it's important for us to understand and keep track of if we're interested in what role the media plays in our everyday lives and in what we hope will be a democracy. So here's a bit of what's going on this week. And there's quite a bit. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin says that he wants to help consumers get cable-like video services from their local telephone companies. On October 26th, he told a U.S. telecommunications industry convention that early next month, the FCC plans to consider new regulations intended to force local governments to expedite the process for getting franchises to provide video services. But he may be trying to fix a problem that only the big telecom companies say is a problem. Franchises are contracts between municipalities and video service providers that give companies access to the public right-of-way for installing cable lines. In exchange, municipalities can negotiate for fees of up to 5% of the company's local revenue. These fees are often paid to fund public service and public access channels. Martin was not specific about what the new regs would look like, but told convention attendees that he is asking his fellow commissioners to review, quote, how the franchising process is working and what actions, if any, the commission should take to fulfill Congress's directive that franchising authorities not grant exclusive franchises or unreasonably refuse to award additional competitive franchises, end quote. Up for interpretation is what Martin considers unreasonable. That's because many municipalities refuse to grant franchises not because they want to block new video services, but because companies continue to get increasingly stingy with regard to the fees they're willing to pay. As major telecommunications companies like SBC and Verizon have gotten interested in offering video services to consumers over their broadband lines, they've also gone on the offensive against the local franchise agreements that their cable competitors have been subject to for more than 20 years. Recently, the Texas Republican governor signed a law eliminating local cable franchises, making the agreements negotiated statewide. This will make Texas the guinea pig for a policy that the telecom industry and many congressional Republicans would like to see become federal law in 2006. Public interest advocates will be watching Texas closely to see what effect the loss of franchise revenue has on municipalities and on public service and public access TV channels. Some observers believe that Martin's effort to force municipalities to, quote, expedite, end quote, franchise negotiations is intended to further spotlight the issue, making it easier for congressional Republicans and telecom lobbyists to portray municipal franchises as a problem that needs to be solved. In addition to local franchise agreements, there are also concerns that telecom companies may filter out video content on the internet from their customers once they get into the cable business. These concerns were stoked this past week when SBC Chief Operating Officer Randall Stevenson was quoted in an industry newsletter saying, quote, we're going to control the video on our network. The content guys will have to make a deal with us, end quote. Stevenson's statement was widely interpreted to mean that his company intends to block on its broadband network the video content of any companies or producers who have not struck a deal with SBC. SBC's public relations people quickly jumped in to deny that interpretation, saying that the company did not intend to block any, quote, lawful, end quote, content from its consumers. The company said that Stevenson's comment was only meant to refer to its television service, not its internet service. But for his part, the newsletter's editor says that Stevenson's quote was not taken out of context, and that it was clear that he and Stevenson were discussing, quote, video delivered directly. Specifically, that video not in their package, end quote. And the U.S. will soon have two fewer telecommunications providers, and the nation's two largest telecom companies are getting bigger. That's because on October 25th, the Justice Department approved SBC's acquisition of AT&T and Verizon's purchase of MCI. Together, the companies will control 90% of the residential telecommunications infrastructure and 70% of business infrastructure. Critics charge that the deal will again create regional telephone monopolies, stifling competition for telephone and data services. The approval requires Verizon and SBC to lease to smaller competitors several hundred unused telecommunications lines that run to buildings serving mostly business customers. The leasing is required in 19 metropolitan areas where either company would be the only telecom provider. Otherwise, the Justice Department placed no significant conditions on the deal. The FCC was scheduled to make a decision on the merger today as we were going into production on October 28th, but the start of the FCC's meeting was delayed several times this afternoon as a result of extended negotiations between the Commission's Republicans who support the merger and the Commission's Democrats who have reservations. The decision is now delayed until a meeting on Monday, October 31st. Right now, Democrats and the FCC are enjoying a little more influence than they normally would during a Republican administration. The FCC is still lacking a fifth commissioner to fill the seat vacated by former Chairman Powell earlier this year. And given the problems the Bush administration is having filling Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's chair, it still doesn't look like the administration will have the opportunity to move through a nomination for the FCC seat anytime soon. And so FCC Democratic Commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein would like to see safeguards imposed on the merger between SBC and AT&T and the merger between MCI and Verizon. They'd like to protect small businesses and consumers. They are reported to be seeking price protections for small businesses who are likely to be negatively impacted by the industry consolidation. Word is that the Dems would also like to see internet service unbundled from local telephone service so that a household would be able to order DSL without also having to have a phone line. May also be looking to impose what is known as network neutrality, where a service provider would be prohibited from blocking or degrading content or service from competitors. Republican FCC Chair Kevin Martin would like to see no additional conditions imposed on the deal. A hard and fast end date for analog TV broadcasts just got a little closer to reality this week when the House Commerce Committee passed its version of a digital TV transition bill. The Senate Commerce Committee passed its version on October 20th. The House approved a date that's a little earlier than the Senate's. The House bill calls for all analog signals to go dark on December 31st, 2008. The Senate's date is April 7th, 2009. The House bill also addresses many more aspects of the transition to digital broadcast than the Senate's. It directs the FCC to start auctioning off vacated analog TV spectrum a little less than a year before all analog TV ends. $990 million of those funds would be earmarked to help households buy converter boxes that allow analog TVs to receive digital broadcasts. By contrast, the Senate earmarked $3 billion. The federal government is expected to reap $10 million from the spectrum auction. The House subsidy would give 10.3 million households the opportunity for a first-come, first-served $40 voucher toward the cost of a converter box with a limit of two per household. An estimated 43 million households still cannot receive digital TV signals. The Senate's bill instead allows households to buy an unlimited number of converter boxes for just a $10 copay each. Converter boxes are expected to cost at least $60 in stores. House Commerce Committee Democrats tried in vain to get the Republican majority to expand a converter box subsidy by sending a voucher to every U.S. household rather than limiting the program to the first 10.3 million households that request one. They accused Republicans of instituting a so-called TV tax on the households that miss out on the converter box vouchers. The House TV bill is now on its way to the Budget Committee before it goes to the House floor as part of a budget bill. The Senate's DTV bill is taking a similar route. If both bills pass, then they will have to be reconciled in conference. So, get ready to buy a new TV. And you are listening to Media Geek. My name is Paul Reisman, and I'm your host. And you can check out Media Geek online at www.mediageek.org. There you'll find the Media Geek blog, full of news and views, all sorts of stuff that we just don't have time for here on the program. And you'll also find a radio program there, too. You can download it in MP3 in the open source Ogg Vorbis format, so you can catch up on something you missed, or you can listen to a program you want to hear again. You can also get the podcast. Have the program automatically downloaded to your computer for your MP3 player, if you like. It's all there at MediaGeek.org. And if you got any comments about the program, if there's something you'd like to hear us cover, or there's something you think we shouldn't do, whatever it is, send along to Paul at MediaGeek.org. And now we're several years into an experiment called Low Power FM, where small 100-watt community stations, nonprofit, are going on the air all over the country. Now, there aren't quite as many as the FCC planned to go on the air when they first announced this service back in 2000. Congress stepped in and decided that they didn't want the station to be put in quite so tightly on the dial because the commercial broadcasters were saying a 100-watt station will interfere with their 10,000 and 100,000-watt stations. But nevertheless, it's going on. In fact, a low-power station is coming on here in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois very shortly, and Media Geek is heard on four other low-power stations around the country. But now a group of radio enthusiasts want to bring that same service, inexpensive, community-based, 100 watts to AM radio. So I talked to Don Shellhart, who is one person behind this petition that the FCC is actually taking serious and may take a look at. And he told me more.
You take as a starting point the kind of low-power radio stations that are currently licensed on the FM band. And I was one of the signatories for the petition in 1997 that got the low-power FM stations established in 2002. So I was in on sort of the design of the LPFM system, you know, along with a lot of other people, but I was one of the players in that. And so what we were trying to do here was to take the idea of low power radio, which is, you know, small radio stations that are focused on a specific community, as kind of a partial antidote to the huge nationwide or international mega corporations that now dominate the airwaves. Take these the idea of these small community-oriented stations, capped in the case of LPFM at 100 watts maximum, and then make changes as necessary to kind of cover points that were not included in the first round of low-power radio on the FM band. So one of our motives here was to let in people who were shut out of LPFM, and that includes individuals and also small businesses. The low-power FM radio service is 100% for organizations, and there's a strong preference in the licensing system, as the FCC established it, for organizations which have, quote-unquote, an established community presence, unquote. And in that sense, it's biased against newcomers. And since one of the things we are hoping to accomplish with the Low Power Radio was to bring outsiders inside the media system, it's only been partially successful. I mean, a lot of the LPFM licenses have gone, for example, to churches or established religious organizations, simply because it's easiest to show a long record of community presence if you're a church, for example. Whereas if you're, say, a former FM pirate, it's harder to show that. Or if you're just an individual, say, Part 15 station operator, it's harder to show that you're an organization with community service record. So we wanted to kind of open up a branch of low-power radio that would be open to the people who can't get into low-power FM now.
You're mentioning entrepreneurs and small business.
So does that mean low-power AM could be a commercial service, not exclusively non-commercial?
Yeah, that's what we advocated. Now, of course, if your commenters don't like, if some of your listeners want it to be 100% non-commercial, like the low-power FM radio service is, then the thing to do is to tell the FCC that they want it to be 100% non-commercial. The solution is not to say, not to tell the FCC to avoid low-power AM completely. Our petition is a starting point for discussion. It's not locked in concrete. Anybody can propose changes in it when the commission goes to the proposed rule. Present petition proposes that the that each individual LPM station, LPAM station, should be able to broadcast commercials if it wants to. Now, that's actually the position of four out of the five petitioners. The petition was signed by the Amherst Alliance, which is a group I used to lead. It's also signed by the Michigan Music is World Class campaign. And then another two petitions are myself and Nick Leggett. Both of us were involved with the first petition for LPFM. Now, the fifth petitioner is a group called the LPAM Network. They're based out of Buffalo, and they're led by William C. Walker. And they differ from the other four petitioners in that they want to require every LPAM station to air commercials. Their theory is that the LPFM service is 100% non-commercial, so the LPAM service should be 100% non-commercial. The other four petitioners feel it should be up to each station.
What is the motivation for allowing stations to be commercial, since a lot of people who are critical of the current media environment chalk up a lot of the problems to commercialism, to the profit motive that drives a lot of programming to the lowest common denominator and even below that. So why do you want low-power AM stations to be commercial?
Well, for one thing, we tend to draw a distinction between big business and small business. And right now we have a media where most of the media is controlled by a few large institutions. And I would include National Public Radio as a kind of mega corporation that happens to be owned by the government, but it operates very much by Clear Channel Communications in some ways. And then at the other extreme, you've got these community-oriented groups that aren't commercial at all. But the small and medium-sized businesses have been largely pushed off the spectrum. They're still around. And so we view this as an unbalanced system. There's totally nonprofit radio, and there's huge mega-corporate standardized radio. And we think there should be a third alternative in the middle there, where there is a profit motive, but because the stations are small, it's focused on making profits in specific communities as opposed to, you know, sort of globally. And so one of the advantages of doing this is that it makes it easier for the LPAM stations to support themselves financially. And in this regard, if William Walker of the LPAM Network were on the air right now, he would tell you that the average AM station has only about 20% of the listenership of the average FM station. So, you know, his argument would be it's tough enough to get along without commercials if you're a low-power FM station, but if you're a low-power AM station, you may start with one-fifth of the listenership of a low-power FM station, so you need that commercial money more than an LPFM station would.
Prior to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, I mean, AM radio was kind of on the ropes. I mean, it was largely considered by the industry a commercial failure, and it was only through consolidation, really, that they were able to sort of revive AM radio, maybe not through good means, but, I mean, is it really feasible that a small 100-watt AM station is going to be able to compete for ad dollars with, you know, the Clear Channel station down the road sufficiently to keep it on the air?
Well, our theory, and this is another public interest argument for allowing LPAM stations to be commercial, our theory is that there are an awful lot of mom-and-pop businesses that used to be able to afford commercial airtime on a small radio station that can't afford the current rates being charged by outfits like Clear Channel Communications. So another one of our arguments for allowing small commercial stations is that you would allow, you know, mom-and-pop pizza to compete with Pizza Hut, have its own commercials, which is really very difficult to do in most areas. In most areas, the only people that afford to advertise on the radio are the Walmarts, the Home Depots, and et cetera.
Maybe we can talk a little bit here about what the service would be like. So with AM stations only running 100 watts of power, I mean, how much coverage would that give the station? And especially what concerns me a bit is nighttime, when we all know the AM band becomes, in many cases, somewhat unusable. It's just a bunch of static, and only the very most powerful stations are able to punch through, in which case they cover huge amounts of area. So, I mean, how much can a low-power AM station cover?
Well, I should mention that I am not an aspiring LPAM broadcaster myself. I'm not an aspiring LPFM broadcaster either. I'm an attorney and a writer by profession. I got into this because I believe that it's good for the country, maybe essential for the country, to have a lot more diverse viewpoints on the airwaves if it wants to remain a democratic republic. So, you know, I'm sort of a do-gooder in this respect. However, I can tell you that I have talked to people who want to get LPAM licenses and who have been, in most cases, have already been operating Part 15 AM stations with a half a watt. And they believe that it's possible for a low-power AM station to be viable. And I'm taking their word for it. I certainly think they should have the chance. The Part 15 radio stations can go out to maybe a half a mile or a mile, from what I understand. The new low-power AM stations that we're proposing, which are probably going to be mostly in the 100-watt range, probably going to be able to go out three to 5 miles. So it makes it tough, particularly when you're starting with one-fifth of the audience that a low-power FM station could count on. But there are people who have been in broadcasting for a number of years who tell me they think it's doable and that they shouldn't be kept by the law from having a chance. I just want to mention one thing before we lose sight of this point, too, is if you look outside of the areas with the most congested FM spectrum, which are mostly in the cities, if you look outside those areas, you can generally find a lot of frequencies for LPFM operation. In the cities, though, or at least many of the cities, there are few, if any, frequencies available for low-power FM at all. There have been some studies done of metropolitan Detroit and metropolitan Boston, which show that even if Congress lifted the channel spacing restrictions on LPFM that had been imposed in 2000, even if Congress lifted those restrictions, there would still be no room on the air for an LPFM station in metropolitan Boston or metropolitan Detroit. So that's another thing that's driving this locomotive, if you want to call it a locomotive, that's overrating the power involved. One thing that's driving it is these folks in the cities who are saying, we don't have a choice between LPFM and LPAM. We won't have any kind of low-power radio at all. It's got to be on the AM band. And so what you really have here is a coalition of two groups, and to some extent they're overlapping, but not completely. You have people like William Walker who are basically looking at small towns, rural areas, maybe small cities, as places where they want to put up their LPAM stations. And they're saying, well, maybe I could find something on the FM band for a low-power radio station, but I couldn't air commercials, and I wanted to be able to air commercials. So that's part of it. And that's for the 70% of the country where there's some degree of frequency of availability for LPFM stations. For the other 25-30% that lives in large metropolitan areas. You got people who are saying, I don't care if it's non-commercial or commercial, frankly. I just want to get on the air. And I can't get on the air unless I have access to the AM band. So that's the other kind of half of the coalition. So you have, you know, basically, if you looked at who's behind this, you could say the folks in the small towns, rural areas, small cities, they can get on the air now, perhaps, with an LPFM, but they want to hear commercials. And then you look at the folks in the larger cities, and they say, we don't give a hoot whether it's commercial or not, we just want to get on the air. And so those are the two different forces, and there's some tension between the two. But they're all agreed on at least getting this process going, like moving the process forward, getting the commission to move from a just a general solicitation of comments to an actual proposed rule where people can argue about the specifics. It's FCC docket number 11287. That's 11287. And also the comment deadline is Monday, November 21st. This is not a proposed rule. This is specifically an invitation to receive comments from the public on the five-party petition. If the comments are sufficiently favorable and the commission likes what it hears, it will then proceed to a proposed rule that has specific details in it. But for right now, really, topic A in this docket is whether they should issue a rulemaking on low-power AM at all. And I stress that because a lot of people think that this is about an up or down vote on the petition that was filed. It's really not. They're not looking for people to come in and say, yes, we like this petition, or no, we don't like this petition. I mean, you can say that if you want to, but you'd be better off if there's something you like in the petition to say specifically what it is. If there's something you don't like, to say specifically what that is, but to encourage the commission to keep going with this process. And, I'm a little concerned that some people will think that if they comment just on the petition, that that's all they have to do. And really the most important thing to do is to say, we need more action on low-power AM, and, the details of the specific petition are up for negotiation. That's up for the FCC to decide when it shapes a proposed rule. But we do want the FCC to act on low-power AM, continue the process of considering low-power AM.
And that was Don Shellhart. He is one of five petitioners who proposed to the FCC that it create a low-power AM radio service. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in 1 week with more news of our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at www.mediageek.org. There you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views on independent media. You'll also find archive editions of the program in MP3 and the open source Ogg Vorbis format. You can also subscribe to the podcast to have the program automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Luo. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Portions of the program are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. Media Geek is also aired on community radio stations KQRP in Salida, California, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, and WTND in Macomb, Illinois. And Media Geek is free to air on your local, non-commercial, or community radio station, too. Just email Paul at mediageek.org. You can use that email address to send comments, too. I'm always interested to know what you think of the show. Again, that's Paul at mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.